So we co-direct the Civic Imagination Project, funded by the MacArthur Foundation, hosted by USC. So what we're going to do today, I'm going to start us off by saying a little bit about what we mean by civic imagination. We're going to talk about the work that we do. We're going to tell a little of our backstory, and we're going to open it up for conversation, review about some of the implications of the kind of work that we've been doing for almost a decade at this point. Actually, more than a decade, thinking about it. But all right, so what do I mean by civic imagination? Well, let's start with the word civic. Civic is one of those things that schools did a really bad job for one generation because they reduced civics to government. And then for another generation, they just abandoned it and ignored it altogether, right? So civic education has been in sharp decline, as any number of people have pointed out, for the last couple of decades, which may explain a lot about the current state of American society. So I make a distinction that is somewhat classical between civics and politics. So politics is about struggles over power, wealth, resources, which can often be sharply partisan. Whereas civic is about this kind of social contract we have with each other as members of a community. So after an election, historically, there was a process of reparations and renewal of the civic that grew out of sort of saying, look, Joe the plumber may be a Republican and I'm a Democrat or whatever, but he's still my plumber and we've still got to work along because we live in the same community. And that made sense in a relatively homogeneous community of relatively little social mobility. So crisis in the civic starts in part as we accelerate social mobility, as we've come to try to embrace diversity, which is a strength to the civic long term, but a shock to the system in the short term. It's something we've got to figure out. So I don't want to be nostalgic about some 50s notion of civic organizations and say bowling or anything like that, right? Because that was a highly exclusive society where vast numbers of people who we would see as our neighbors today would not have been included in the notion of the civic. But we're at a point where if the campaign never ends, if legislation is never accepted, if we don't believe in the results of elections, that we reach a point where the civic keeps getting ground down and is never renewed or brought back together again. And that's a really important problem we're facing right now. So our work is really about figuring out how do we make civics work again? How do we reimagine it so that it is actually more inclusive than it was before, build back better and all of that, right? So we got to build the civic back better. And then it's about what is the role of imagination in the civic. So starts from the premise that before you can build a better world, you've got to imagine what a better world looks like. You've got to see yourself as a civic agent capable of making change. You have to imagine yourself as part of a larger community of shared interests. And Benedict Anderson calls this an imagined community. We call it an imagining community because we don't see it as fixed or static or locked down. It's an ongoing process we all participate in terms of imagining ourselves as a community that has shared interest we need to achieve. It requires us to imagine a process of change. What does change look like? How do we achieve change in the current system? And if you have no belief the system is going to change with you, then what you have to do is imagine what a different system looks like. For those who, you know, we have to imagine and engage empathetically with perspectives that differ from our own. And for those who are most oppressed, marginalized, you often have to imagine freedom, dignity, respect, democracy, all the good stuff before you directly experience them. You put that together, and that's a powerful chunk of what imagination contributes to the civic. The civic is one big...
You lost your mic.
Yes, the civic is one big project of imagining differently. And that's the essence of our work, or what guides our work, is to think about it. Now, at different moments in time and history, people use different resources to imagine otherwise. So in the Smithsonian Institute, which I love, there is a statue of George Washington wearing a toga and sitting on Apollo's throne. And I call it Cosplay George, right? Because I don't think the historical George Washington ever wore a toga. Maybe at like a party for his fraternity at William and Mary, I don't know. But picturing George on a rampage kegger is the only plausible explanation. But actually the explanation is that the Greek and Roman democracies loom large in the civic imagination of the founding fathers of the United States, right? That they all went to liberal arts colleges, the future Ivies, and as a result, they had a shared vocabulary in Greek and Latin that allowed them to imagine the world in a certain way. Or Martin Luther King uses the Book of Exodus a lot. I've been to the mountaintop, I've seen the promised land, I won't be able to get there with you. All of that stuff out of the story of Moses is because he's speaking to the leadership of the Black church, and the Bible was a shared text. And today, the civic imagination, the kind of fundamentals of it, come from popular culture. Young people all over the world are using a vernacular from popular culture to talk about social change, right? It could be students marching through the streets in Hong Kong singing "Can You Hear the People Singing" from Les Mis. It could be people dressed up like handmaids and going to the state capitol to fight for reproductive rights. It could be the Harry Potter Alliance, which has had hundreds of thousands of young people in fights for human rights advocacy, or the three-finger salute, which has been picked up and used for wealth inequality movements all over the planet, or the role that Tolkien has played in the alt-right. There's all kinds of ways that pop culture for all kinds of people is functioning today as the foundation for the civic imagination. And so part of our work has been just documenting that process, looking at what's happening when Zelensky is being compared to Captain America, but with Ukrainian colors, for example. That's kind of imagery. It comes up in memes, it comes up in street protest. There's very little difference, it seems to me, between the Hall H at San Diego Comic-Con and the costumes I see at street protest right now, which represent a whole variety of superhero wizards, zombies, and so forth. That just is the way young people foment politics today, because that is the shared language more than the Bible or classical literature that they use to think through what the what the future might look like. So I'm rattling on. I should turn it over to you.
Oh, well, I guess. So a lot of our work is also about practice. So we do the theoretical inquiry, but we also are very committed and enjoy working with communities and with our partner organizations. And I just want to take us back to the first workshop that we ever ran. We were coming off of a multi-year study of youth and digital media and pop culture. And we had done an in-depth study of American Muslim youth. And we had decided to work with the same community who were at some point research subjects as partners. So we decided to run our first ever world building workshop. And we arrived very excited to be encouraging political thought among young people in the mosque. And it was me, Carl Bauman, and Gabriel Peters Lazaro. And the first hour, and Susu Attar, who was the coordinator there. And within the first hour, we realized that our premise was completely wrong. We were like, the young people we were there with did not want to talk about their already politicized identities. They didn't want to talk about another instance of how they felt as American Muslims put on the spot to represent for their community in ways that maybe they didn't even want to. What they wanted to do was imagine possibilities, like what Henry's saying. And so there was this moment where we walked out of the room after the first hour, we're like, we need to rethink. We need to rethink this. We thought we were going to be connecting specifically directly to civics. And instead, we ended up opening up the space and we say, let's do a future world brainstorm about the world you want to see. And suddenly we had lions that were spitting knowledge. We had cows jumping over the moon and bringing the milk back from the moon. We did have flying carpets, and we had all kinds of stories, and the youth just lit up and got excited. And they ended up making short films about this and a newscast from the future, which we all watched together, and they were just committed and excited about talking about these stories that they had created together and how they'd imagined what the future could be, 2060, 2050, I think is the track we're on, so let's go with 2050. And as we watched it, the critique started to creep in. So it was like, it was not an escape, essentially. It wasn't an escapist activity. Because as we started to review it, some of the young women had created a fantastical, comical story that involved bombs exploding, comical bombs exploding. And one of the youth in the room said, you can't do that. You cannot create the story. As an American Muslim young woman, you cannot create the story. And we had a huge discussion about, well, why not? Why can't they create the stories that they want to create just as much as anybody else would want to create? What does their identity mean in this? How does this relate to their civic identities in the spaces that they occupy? And what does it mean for their collective imagination? And this embarked us on this deep commitment to just always supporting the collective imagination, to not constricting it with the civic or the political from the get-go, and just opening up the doors for people. So I think we've used the metaphor of the green space in stories where people escape into a different place for a while and then come back and see their reality in a different way. That's very much how we see the workshops that we have. We now have many distinct workshops, but of the key ones that we have are six that map onto the practices of the civic imagination that Henry mentioned. So we have one around thinking about memory. So people bring in memory objects that really matter to them and share those. And I have run this workshop with folks 20, 30 times, and I'm always moved by them. And I remember these stories because they're just stories that about grandmothers, about past work that people are linked to, stories of migration. And strangers come together, and within half an hour, they're hugging, they're crying, because it just cuts through a lot of the differences that we think we have to the core of what makes us human. We have a workshop around building a shared futures. I will not say a shared future. Specifically, we are looking to build pluralistic futures. So that's very much in the spirit of, like, imagine what the world could, normally if I was running this, we'd be doing a brainstorm because I always want to hear what the room has to say. Imagine like the world of 2050, what would you like it to look like? What was the fantastical vision that you have for it? Let's throw reality out the window for a second. We have a workshop about reimagining space. What if this convention center could be something else in the future? What would it look like as a monument from the future? We have a workshop also about just developing a scenario of success for people who are actually taking action around particular things. Rather than thinking about a problem mindset only, we add to it a success mindset. So imagine doing a newscast again from the future, imagining what would happen if the campaign that you were running has been successful. So that's very much in the space of what we do. We've run this with folks, I would say, from, you know, in Lebanon, we ran it with educators from various countries that were actually have conflicts going on. We ran it with them there. We've run it in Austria. We've run it with coal miners and tobacco farmers in Kentucky around the future of work, where we collaborate with Sam Ford. We've run it with interfaith groups in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Idaho, Texas, Montana. It's been a wonderful, pre-COVID, wonderful trip that I got to take to be in all these places and work with these communities.
Yeah, so what is this to do, have to do with speculative fiction? Well, hopefully those of you who are immersed in the world of science fiction and fandom, as I am, recognize some elements there, like world building or remixing, are kind of central practices within fan cultures. And we'll talk a bit about how this emerges from work that I've been doing for almost 30 years on fandom and the way we make meaning from popular culture in the context of our everyday lives. But to give you an example, and when we build the future, we do world building, we often just throw out categories. What is the future of health? What is the future? When we get to transportation, almost inevitably, we hear about the teleportation system in Star Trek, right? Beam me up, Scotty, right? Because we don't rule out, this is not scenario planning. We're not looking for plausible futures. The future is not the product. It's the center point of a process which gets people articulating shared values, aspirations, hopes, and fears, and hearing each other speak maybe for the first time, about what kind of community they want to live in. So when the teleportation system rises in the US, most often I've heard it in terms of carbon footprints. So does beaming from place to place have a different environmental impact than flying pieces of metal fuel using fossil fuels, right? When we've done it in Europe, what we heard a lot was about efficiencies, right? Trying to get between European capitals by rail and having to change trains and all of that, and just suddenly you can be Brussels to Berlin in like a blink of an eye. When we did it in Beirut, we heard about safety, because the folks there were very concerned about the Syrian refugees who were dying trying to get to Germany, and what would happen if instead of these leaky boats, they were able to just beam in. And we've done it with immigrant rights advocates in the US and elsewhere. We heard a lot about green cards, right? So when Kirk, Spock, and McCoy beam down on Star Trek, no one's there to check their papers. There's no border guard, there's no wall. Right, they beam down wherever they want, and they're integrated into society instantly. And so the fantasy that Star Trek offers is of a world where all of that apparatus that is so much in contemporary debate just disappears, and the world becomes totally open. Each of those represents discrete fantasies that are framed around the same, you know, science fiction technology. So by opening that up and including magic from Harry Potter or tech from Star Wars or whatever, we get to a place where people can say something that they may not even recognize about themselves talking about it. But this is well within the traditions of speculative fiction. Go back to Hugo Gernsback, the father of modern science fiction, who was an advocate of amateur radio at a time when there was as many, the idea was there would be as many transmitters as receivers. It would form the basis of a participatory culture. And Gernsback built around science fiction, which he saw as a means of popular science education in the US, an apparatus of fandom where those ideas would be intensely debated. And from the beginning, science fiction fandom was a deeply political space. The technocracy movement, which originates in the early 30s at about the same time science fiction is emerging, out of which comes Social Security, for example, credit cards, a number of things that we have today come out of that meeting of science fiction and, you know, politics. So when, say, the Anonymous movement confronted the Church of Scientology, you had a political movement that was born out of anime fans confronting a religious movement that came out of science fiction fandom. There's a lot in the modern world we only understand if we can re-embed it in this history of science fiction, which has, throughout its history, been an important venue for key debates around change. So by borrowing from science fiction fandom, we've been able to infuse these discussions. And what we're discovering is people are very good at speculating, both forward and backward in time. So what's the world of 2060, and how did we get there, is a kind of core set of questions we use. More recently, we did something online where we asked people around the world to share what future historians from 2060 would say about COVID and what it has impacted the world. And so we got this, we go forward in time, then we look back in time. Those movements come straight out of the language of speculative fiction, and they're very powerful ways to think our way through and beyond a current crisis. Last thing I'll say, and I'll turn it back to Sangeeta, is that we often heard in the face-to-face workshops that we needed a complete meltdown of the society before we could actually imagine fundamental reworking of the system, right? People needed to imagine an apocalypse before they could imagine a utopia. So the question we had going through COVID was, is COVID, the global pandemic, the apocalyptic meltdown that now allows us to imagine a better world? And how do we move from just being in the state of despair and divide coming through this pandemic to a place where we can imagine what a better world looks like and work to achieve it? And that's the question I think the Civic Imagination Project is asking right now.
And it's shifting a lot over time. So that project, which is called the Atlas of the Civic Imagination, was launched within the first months of the pandemic, so exactly 2 years ago, I guess, in March. And we have been tracking that over time. And we've seen just a shift where, you know, people, there was even a breakdown of the imagination at one point. People just couldn't imagine anything. Like they were just like, just living every day to, you know, to understand what was happening. And then we saw an imagination of how we're going to come out of this. And now we're seeing a lot of reflection. We actually have a project that's called Through My Window, where we're asking people to reflect back on what's happened over the past 2 years and what that means moving forward. So we're living in a time where compressing time in different ways is actually profoundly meaningful, and it's shifting very quickly. Like probably 6 months ago to 6 months from now feel very different in terms of what your imaginations are. One thing I do want to say about the imagination piece is that for us, I say it's not about, Henry already said, it's not about imagination, it's about imagining. So it's the process of imagining together. So the collective imagining process together. So it's not about an individual's imagination of a certain thing. That is, of course, what's coming into this. But then the workshops and the sessions themselves are about that messy negotiation of what happens when we merge our imaginations. And that's the point of everything. So we have a workshop that's called Remixing Stories. We remix people's personal stories that inspire them. So we ask people to bring in a story that's personally inspiring. Could be a pop culture story, could be a story from their faith tradition, it could be a story of a biographical story. And then we put them in groups and we ask them to remix those stories to create something new. So in that context, the person who has the personal investment in the story is present. So they can talk through what's appropriate, what's not, when is it appropriation in the negative sense of the word. And they also identify what the common themes and threads are. And so in doing that, they do a lot of work in finding connection with each other, in imagining a new story. And as we were doing these workshops, we discovered essentially, almost by accident, that we were doing a lot of work in bridging divides. We were, by bringing people together in this way and not starting from an issue, but starting from stories that matter to them that could be fictional, so they could be reworked, we were actually bringing people together to see each other in a way that they hadn't. We were just cutting through all the, hey, how are you, what's your name, to, this is the most important thing that matters to me, and this is the story that inspires me every day. And going for that and say, and now that story has to be connected to somebody else's story as well. And so that's been actually our recent work, has been moving into spaces where we are consciously bridging divides. So bringing people together who do see issues differently, maybe politically, maybe on other issues, and bringing them together to start to build a space where they can see each other as they are in a different way, in a way that actually helps them connect, not necessarily resolve the issue, but connect with each other in a way that they hadn't before. So that's been where a direction where our work has been going recently.
So how do we get here? So let's begin with our personal origin stories and then go to the organizational origin story a little bit. So I'm born in Atlanta. I'm third generation Atlantan. My family had lived in Atlanta since my father left the South Georgia farm to go to fight in World War I. And as the song of the era said, how do you keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? So he was, in fact, moved to the city, became a sheet metal worker. And I grew up in Atlanta in the 60s. And Atlanta in the 60s is highly segregated culture. I'm pumped full of lost cause ideology. Which is a powerful civic imagination. Whether we think it's a constructive one or not is something I think we're, probably not today. It's not one that I find reprehensible. At the same time, I see the South as still working through the legacy of that powerful belief system that I was taught through every organization in my life. But it's countering it were two things. One was Star Trek, and the other was Martin Luther King, right? And so growing up in Atlanta, watching Star Trek on television, seeing Martin Luther King, in Atlanta, gave me a vision of what an alternative to the lost cause culture of the South might look like. And, Star Trek had the first interracial kiss on American television. The story is Nicole Nichols went to the March on Washington planning to quit the show because she was fed up with just saying hailing frequencies are open, Captain, right? And King said to her, look, the fact that you are visible on the bridge in a command position says my dream is a possibility, that you stand for something that matters to massive numbers of people. So Uhura was one hallmark of, you know, Chekhov, Sulu, of a multicultural society. Even Spock is, you know, maybe especially Spock, stood in for an idea of a more diverse society than I saw when I went to school or I went to church. And so I grew up as a fan, and fandom was my way out of the myopia of the world that I was living in and to another set of possibilities. Some of my earliest work out of grad school was a book called Textual Poachers, Television Fans, and Participatory Culture, which was about fans. Fans not as couch potatoes, not as people who needed to get a life, but fans as creative people, critical people, civically connected people who were used television as the raw materials to sort through the mythology of their lives. And so that is kind of my route toward this. A couple other steps along the way that Sangeeta and I took together. But Sangeeta, why don't you say a little bit about your background?
So in some ways, Henry and I couldn't be more different. I mean, it's surprising that we met, but we met because of the interest in creativity and fandom. So I grew up between what was then Czechoslovakia and Nepal, so definitely nowhere close to Georgia. And
the other Georgia.
To the other Georgia, yes, and closer to other parts of the world that we may or may not talk about today. So, my family, and I'm a product of an unlikely love story, I like to say, because my parents, they met for love at first sight, and then both the government said, no, you will not be together. So we spent my childhood moving between Czechoslovakia and Nepal, neither of which was very excited to have us. So we moved 5 times by the time I was 18, you know, moving back and forth between the two countries, depending on what the most recent immigration policy was. And I was just trying to figure out who I was. It was a really complicated situation where, like, I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. And then in the depths of my despair, I discovered Bollywood. And Bollywood to me, you know, I was in Kathmandu, so not in India, but Bollywood to me, in its mixing, and it's like just messiness at the time, just this messy mixing of cultures. And you could see, you know, there was even problems in terms of sometimes the set, the things didn't align. Like the set looked this way in one shot, and then it looked different in the next shot, a second later. But I just loved it because it was kind of reflecting this disconnected life that I felt I was living. And by imitating the dances in the films, I discovered who I was. I discovered my body, I discovered that I could move, and I discovered that I could be a person that could contain all these different contradictions, and that I could, you know, be that, and that could be me. And so I took that love of Bollywood maybe a little too seriously. I just kept going with it. Because of Bollywood, I became a dancer. I actually went on to study technique. But because of Bollywood too, I met Henry, because we met when he was still at MIT, and I knew that I was interested in Bollywood, but I didn't dare say that that's what I wanted to study. And Henry was like, why not? And just that, I remember that specifically, why not? If that's what you're interested in, do that. And I was like, oh, okay. So I ended up doing a multi-sided ethnography of different Bollywood cultures. I looked at Bollywood dancers in Prague. I looked at Bollywood dancers in Nepal. I looked at Bollywood dancers in Mumbai. I looked at Bollywood dancers in Los Angeles. And I talked about the ways in which they took content that was contained in films and reinterpreted it, made it their own to reflect their current realities, right? And then there was actually a reciprocal relationship, because it's not like the makers of the creators of the dances in the films in India were ignorant to this. They knew this was happening, and so they were carefully watching. And so, in fact, they were then adapting these movements back in. And so I started to talk about this relationship in which, essentially, the imagination of the fans was inspiring the imagination that was going to be in the films as well. And so this collective imagination around what Bollywood means and what it could mean to people was really where I think Henry and I meet in some ways, because we look at very different content, but we look at it in similar ways. So maybe our shared history now a little bit.
Yeah. So it's been almost 10 years since I was at South by Southwest the last time. And at the peak of that, I was talking about convergence culture where old and new media collide, and then spreadable media creating value and meaning in a network society. And then I moved to University of Southern California, reconnected with Sangeeta, formed this research group. And we've since then been doing work on the civic and the political, starting with a book called By Any Media Necessary, which was about young activists and trying to counter this idea that they were either slacktivists or that they were only involved with Twitter revolutions, right? And we wanted to argue they were trying to make change by any media necessary, right? That whatever media they had access to, whatever communication channel they could use, they were going to use that to get their message out. And, you know, more recently, I've done some writing about the Parkland kids and March for Our Lives, which is a spectacular example of the ways in which these kids who were being raised, you know, yes, in an elite private school in Florida with really good civics teachers and media teachers, went within about a month and a half from giving talks in their high school to standing in front of the National Mall in front of thousands, if not millions, of people, certainly millions by the time we put them on CNN, talking about gun violence in the United States, and passing something like 180 state and local laws that they lobbied for over in the time since. This has been one of the most effective, you know, movements around gun violence in the United States in history. Run off, you know, heavily run by young, you know, high school, now college age students. But what we discovered is we were looking at all the stuff we did. The book has case studies of Invisible Children and CUNY 2012. This is the 10-year anniversary of it, as the New York Times reminds us. The CUNY 2012, Invisible Children, Harry Potter Alliance and Nerd Fighters, American Muslim Youth, Young Libertarians, and...
Youth who mobilize around the DREAM Act.
Yes, the DREAMers.
Yeah.
We looked at. But all of them had some notion of the civic imagination expressed through pop culture. So we kept seeing these common grounds. And sort of the critique of Harry Potter Alliance is, these are young geeks, white geeks, who don't really understand the world and need the help of fantasy in order to engage with reality, right? That's the critique. So we turn to something like DREAMers, where these people are directly fighting for their right to stay in this country, and they're using Superman to tell their story, right? So the idea is there is not such a thing as an illegal alien. They're undocumented people. We accept that. But if there were an illegal alien, it might be Kal-El from the planet Krypton, right? Because Kal-El's parents send them away to a new world in search of a better life. They cross the border in the middle of the night, land in Kansas, get raised by this Anglo couple that teaches him to lie about who he is and where he's come from. Yet nevertheless, he goes out and fights for truth, justice, and the American way of life, dressed in his ethnic garb because the Superman outfit is made from the blankets his mother's wrapped him in when they sent him away from Krypton. And young DREAMers find this a powerful way to explain to their classmates what's happened to them, right? How it comes that they see themselves as Americans even if they cross the border illegally. That story is a really important one for explaining their situation. So that opened us up to this idea of the civic imagination. What stories do we tell to make sense of who we are politically, civically? For me, it was Star Trek. For these kids, it's Superman. Now, the interesting thing about Superman is the kids who created it, and they were high school age kids who created Superman in the 30s, were Eastern European Jewish immigrants. And that for them, it was a story about immigration all along. And so somehow, their story spoke over a 70-year period of time to a whole new generation of immigrant rights activists who found it the most powerful way to talk about their own experiences. So pop culture is always there, and whether it is through the case studies of activist groups and how they're using pop culture that form the basis of our book, Popular Culture and the Civic Imagination, or the basis for the workshops where we're doing world building and remixing and all of that, which is the basis for Practicing Futures.
Yeah, I think we're going to slowly open it up to folks. I think the last thing I'll say is that, you know, just in terms of the linear of the journey we've been on, where our work is taking us now is, I've already mentioned some of this, but we are doing actively now engaging with folks around bridging difference. So we're trying to think about how we can use the civic imagination there. We also pursue our passions and interests. So we have a small initiative around plant-based democracy. So what would we imagine if plants and nature had a say in the decisions that we make, where we're looking to speak with people who may not identify as climate change activists, but have a real relationship with the plants that they nurture in their gardens, in their pots, and or that they paint through arts, and we're speaking with them about that. We also have many foodies in our group. We run a research group at USC, so we have a whole Feeding the Civic Imagination initiative, where we're looking at how food connects us to the imagination and how we think about food and the civic imagination together. And we also are building on some work that we've already been doing with media creatives, where we're launching a small incubator around how the civic imagination can inform the creative process, all the way from ideating and world building through to community building and then spreading and distributing the work out there. So how do we think about that in terms of the relationship between production and consumption of media? So those are some of the directions we're going, and we're really excited to be partnering with WKU and working in Kentucky, which is great for us from California just to get out of the state as well. So we're launching a small incubator there this fall. So those are just some directions that we're heading in.
And you didn't mention transformative media pedagogy.
Oh, I did not mention. I just can't even keep track of everything we're doing. I have this checklist, but I think of like this kitchen with many pots boiling, and I just have to constantly lift up the lids to make sure. We also, we've been applying the work we do to pedagogic spaces. So thinking about how the approach of the imagination and civic imagination can be adopted in teaching media practices in classrooms. And that work is in a book that just came out 4 or 5 months ago called Transforming Media Pedagogies, and I'm also happy to share with folks if you're interested in that from a sort of more pedagogical standpoint. But I think we will transition to, we'd love to hear from you. That's the most interesting part. So if folks have questions, thoughts, comments, we'd love to, I guess the mics, are we supposed to use the mics?
You're supposed to have people come to the mic.
Please come to the mic and yes.
Hi, thank you for this great panel. I'm really enjoying it. This morning when I zapped on the TV, I saw, I think, about 20, 30 sports programs, not one journalistic program, not one news program about the situation in Europe. So I'm wondering, while I'm listening to you, so do you see that fake news and maybe a decline of interest in quality journalism affects the ability for people to really engage in civic imagination?
Well, it's definitely a concern. I mean, I have one of my multiple appointments at USC is in the journalism school, and I, you know, as someone who trains journalists, I certainly care about the infrastructure for information. I think we can't the notion of a civic imagination depends both on the myth and awareness of the reality. If it becomes all myth, it becomes very, very dangerous because we're drifting off. But myth can engage us with real concerns, may get us to have a system of communication across differences around those real concerns, and may allow us to think beyond the current reality. And all of those are important parts of the imagination in the civic process. So I don't want all information all the time, right? And the idea of the informed citizen only gets us so far in terms of thinking about what we need for democracy. An informed citizen with no heart and no imagination is not what is needed in order to deal with the changes we're facing. That said, quality journalism really is foundational, right? If we lose that, then we lose the ability to hold governments accountable. We lose the ability to investigate labor practices at Amazon, for example, which is an important part of understanding the world we live in today. We lose the ability to have some shared facts, if at all possible, that allow discussion and debate. You know, one of the problems right now is we don't fundamentally agree in the United States about anything factual about the state of our society, and that's in part the withering of civic education, and it's in part the withering of quality journalism that puts us in that situation. So how do we come together? I here in the South, you know, the tearing down of monuments is an important part of a political process to shift the imagination of the United States. But so far, it's all about negation. So how do we come together and figure out what the South stands for, what a multicultural 21st century South stands for? That's a process of the civic imagination, and that's a process that requires collective deliberation across divides. It is grounded in fact, but has to go beyond it, just like the symbols of a previous generation of the South had some factual basis. I mean, there was a guy named Robert E. Lee. He didn't necessarily have all the traits I was taught to ascribe to a Robert E. Lee. But it was that mix of fact and fantasy which made the segregation of the South such a powerful institution and so difficult to change. So if we're going to change the South, and as a son of Georgia, I very much think we need to change the South, we need to think about what a new shared mythology might look like that brings Southerners together. And that is, journalism is part of that, but not necessary, but not sufficient, I guess is the way I would put it.
All right, go for it.
Yeah, thanks. I was wondering if you have a point of view on...
I always have a point of view.
I bet. But speculative artists of the past, like Arthur C. Clarke or Douglas Adams, the tools that they used to describe the future versus the tools that modern-day artists or speculative artists have at their disposal, so metaverse, world-building, so much more. Is it easier or harder, do you think, for artists of today? Because, you know, like when you was just writing a novel and describing geostationary satellites, like people could just imagine and the imagination could go to science and then it become reality. But in a way, maybe in world building, it's too precise, or it's, you know, it leaves too little to the imagination. So just wondering. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's an interesting question. I'm going to teach at USC in the fall a course on imaginary worlds that's going to take up some of that multimodal world building that we're seeing today. And so I'm very interested in that side of it. Maybe we take two examples of recent efforts to build worlds in science fiction. One is the Black Panther film. And Wakanda is a powerful world that has affected the imaginations all over the planet, in part by imagining an alternative Africa to the one that has been the dominant stereotype in the West, one that is high-tech, one that has never been colonized, one that is not riven with tribal divides and historical fragmentation, but instead tribes may have differences, but they're working together, one that has strong presence, powerful women as opposed to a patriarchy, you know, one that is going to be a global leader, a superpower. All of that was built. It was all in the comics before, and got to remember, Ta-Nehisi Coates, among others, was writing for Black Panther before the film ever came out, but the film pushed it out there in really powerful ways. And I saw an incredible debate, public debate, between an African and an African-American about the film, and the African was outraged by the pan-African imagery that he felt just blurred. Once again, Africa was being treated as a country rather than a cluster of countries. And the African-American said, I don't know what part of Africa my ancestors came from. So having a pan-African imaginary gives me a way of feeling that connection to the mother country without having to get down into which country, which tribe, and so forth. So that's on the one hand. It's very powerful. And it's put Afrofuturism at the center of debates worldwide. The other hand, there's a slow building up of interest in solarpunk at the moment, which is about imagining sustainable futures. It's explicitly a movement that combines activism and the civic and the imagination. And they collaboratively are building a kind of vision of the future as much through art as through writing, but both, that is global. Those key writers often come from Brazil or Japan, India, countries that are in dialogue with the United States, and it may be the first American science fiction movement that's seriously been shaped by global dialogue rather than America's cultural imperialism exporting its fantasies to the rest of the world. So it is possible, but I think more of you have heard about Afrofuturism and Black Panther than have heard about solarpunk. Solarpunk has not yet reached a text that gets into that multimodal system that you're talking about, that really brings it alive for people. There are not very many solarpunk games, say. There's not a big solarpunk film yet. So I would predict in the next 5 years we get there, but it's slowly building itself up through literature, through fandom, through art, art on the internet, and through activism and fashion design. It is a multimedia movement, but it is not, doesn't have the weight that Hollywood can put behind a multimedia movement to make something visible.
Yeah, I don't really have too much to add to that, but I do think also looking in other contexts, where I work a lot with media makers who are based outside of the United States, and they may not have the resources to create a top-down sort of transmedia franchise or thinking about, you know, using multimodal storytelling in that way. And so for those media makers thinking, well, in our language, through any media necessary, has actually been incredibly helpful for them to think about how they're going to tell their story. So that, you know, not thinking of themselves as necessarily just making a documentary or a series, but just freeing their mind up in terms of thinking in a way that crosses different media has been helpful, even though they don't necessarily have the resources to do it in the way that we would imagine for, let's say, Black Panther. All right, go ahead.
Hi, I'm coming at this from my background's in interaction design, and this, you have a lot of overlap with the book called Speculative Everything by Dun and Ravi, you might be familiar mm-hmm. with.
Yes.
And, you know, with discursive design, design fiction, speculative design, we use the process of making to express these ideas. And you mentioned, to imagine these alternative futures and new imaginaries, and you mentioned during your workshops, sometimes it's hard for people to get to that part of their brain and imagine these new futures. I guess, could you talk a little bit more about the tools you use during your workshops to help people get to that point? And also, you mentioned like comic books. What is maybe really great about that medium and what does it maybe lack in? Yeah.
You want to talk about the design part of it a little?
Yeah, bit? So we are actually very influenced by speculative design. Gabriel Peters Lazaro, a close colleague of ours who unfortunately passed away this year, was crucial to bringing that perspective to the team. So he would have spoken to this better than me, but I'm going to try and channel him a little bit. So we were always very keen to have people think through while they're doing without feeling intimidated, because it's always about lowering the threshold for feeling like they're going to fail, right? You must know this. Feeling like they're going to fail or feeling like they're going to be somehow inadequate. And so we have two methods for this. One is that we plunge them right into it. Through our intentionality. So for example, when we do in-person workshops, we use no tech, right? We come in with markers and boards, and that's intentional because we don't want to come in as somehow experts presenting something but really to bring it to like this, we are all on this equally. And then we break down the very classical things. We break down the task. We provide constraints. So when we do the world building of stories, we have very specific instructions around the kinds of characters, plots, like so that, you know, when people get stuck, they can kind of latch onto these micro steps together. And then also wherever we can, we help make sure that people are invested in the material. So this is why the personal connection is really important. So it's not like, I mean, for us, we're not coming together to design something that's abstract to them. It's something that they care about, so a personal story, an observation of the place that they all share, you know, so they already have an investment in the place or in the reality that they're going to be departing from or that they're going to be imagining on top of, would be kind of the quick answer to that. But I'm happy to share like our actual instructions to like how that works in our practice.
Yeah, and then comics. I mean, comics is, to me, one of the most interesting media out there. My most recent solo book was called Comics and Stuff, and is all about know, and then stuff, sort of the withering off of confidence that leads to comics and stuff that I kept hearing my students. But it's really about mise-en-scène and material culture and comics and how we represent our objects, the things that matter to us through comics. And that's sped over into the use of memory objects as a resource for in our work. I read all this anthropology of things and objects and stuff that led to that book. So I'm interested in comics is the short version of that. Why? Well, first of all, it's a cheaper form of production than any other mass media. It combines words and images, which gives it a kind of multimodal experience, a depth of engagement that's somewhat different from words alone or images alone. It's quicker to reproduce, right? So if you look at the turnaround cycles of mass media, any trend is most likely to first appear in comics and then be absorbed by the other parts of the mass media system because of the speed and efficiency of getting comics out into the world. It takes several years to do a Hollywood film or to make a television series or a AAA game. You can go from zero to 100 in like a month with comics publishing if you want to, and it's usually 2 to 3 months delay between when the story is complete and when it reaches the store. So it's the first barometer for social change. Now, when I was in India, I discovered this movement called the People's Comics Movement, where people were getting kids and activists and people in the slum to design comics to tell their stories. And in India, that takes on added importance because of the linguistic barriers between people there. The visuals transcended those barriers more immediately than words would have done or spoken words would have done. And so it has become an important media for social change around the planet.
So we're a little
short on time, so I think maybe we'll do 2 questions. Is that?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, let's do 2 questions and then we'll answer. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
That's great.
We talk long. I apologize. We'll go into the speed answer round.
You don't need to give up asking the question, though.
Okay. We'll do our best to get everyone in, but we...
No, actually, the culture of convergency was the very first time I've heard about transmedia, and back in the day when you were in South by Southwest last time. And from then to today, I now work with virtual reality, which is basically word building all the time. My question touches a little bit about journalism, too, because I believe that we are very focused on things that are going wrong in the world, and word building is... I don't know, maybe we have another chance to have another form of what we are looking at. So my question is, like, do you believe that we have a chance? How do we turn good news, not in a naive way, but, like, make it people aware of the world that's not as bad as we think it is, make it sexier in these new platforms?
Okay. So that's question one. Let's get question two, and then we'll answer. I'm going to answer that one. You take whatever comes
next. All right, thanks. I'm not put on the spot.
You get what's behind door number two.
Okay.
But I do know what to say to that.
Hi, I'm Rocio from Argentina, and my company is called Unplastify, and our mission is to change the human relationship with plastics. So we tackle the plastic pollution problem from the prevention side and not recycling. So much of what we do is changing that narrative, that recycling, we think that it's not enough. So we work a lot with the future and reimagining possible scenarios where plastics don't exist, and it's really very difficult. So what I wanted to ask you is if you've worked with other environmental problems, and what recommendations do you have to rethink this or similar scenarios if you've already worked with another types of these problems?
Yeah, I think
you
I
got that it. One.
I got that one.
Okay. Right.
I'll think of an answer while he's
in there. All right. Oops. Totally clumsy with this thing today. All right. So as someone who's in a field where critical perspectives dominate, I constantly ask my colleagues, don't tell me what you're against, tell me what you're for. Because that's the hard part. It's easy to identify billionaires and billionaires or whatever, you know, capital or whatever it is as bad. We get that. But what is good? How do we get there? To me, I see the role of scholarly intervention as starting with description. We need to identify what the problem actually is. critique is part of that. But beyond that is advocacy, where we identify alternative solutions and push those forward. And finally is intervention, where we make a difference on the ground to make sure those things get taken up and applied. And this project is somewhere between advocacy and intervention, primarily in the way in which we situate ourselves. Now, what would that mean for journalism? Well, for journalism, one thing is there's a tradition of civic journalism, where you get a community together and you hear what their concerns are, right? And that informs your coverage. There's also now a tradition of speculative journalism, where you look, you use what you know about the present to map what the future might look like. So what would a speculative civic imagination journalism look like? You do practices to identify the futures people would like to live in, and then we go on and find the people today who are working to achieve those futures. And it could be getting rid of plastics, it could be, you know, designing new research for how we might live in a more sustainable environment, it could be any number of things. But the point is, the coverage is led by not the current problem, but what alternatives look like and who is working to achieve those alternatives. And I don't think that's naive at all. I mean, it doesn't say we believe everything's going to happen, no problems. It simply means that we see the value of what focusing attention on people who are trying to change the world.
I'm going to take the final question just so you don't have to stand there anymore, and then I'll answer the plastics.
Okay,
and then I'll
see.
I can't believe this worked. Oh, my God. Okay, so I came in a little bit late, and I apologize if I'm asking you something you already talked about, but I'm a librarian who teaches ethics to engineers at an engineering college, and one of my big challenges as an academic is the bifurcation of STEM and liberal arts or humanities or social science, or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
You got Henry at that.
Yeah.
So what I'm wondering is about, I mean, you work at a much larger institution than I do. I have 350 students at my college. So we are able to do cross-disciplinary classes a lot more easily, but in an institution like yours, which is much, much larger, how does that play out for trying to get a diversity of sort of like academic perspectives of students in the room? Because I think that STEM people need this sort of more than anyone, and often they don't see how this fits into their career goals.
Okay, okay. So
sorry, that was a lot.
You do environment, I do STEM, and then we'll
Wrap
it up.
All right, so we're gonna jump around a little bit. So on the plastics, so the question was around recommendations that I would have. So it brings to mind the work that we're doing around plants and the civic imagination, which is, I think, the closest, that's where our work around climate change and those kinds of questions has been. So my response would be to think about the affective, how to get at the affect related to this, the emotional bond. So just as an example, in speaking to people who don't think about the environment necessarily too much, maybe passively, but care about plants, care about their vegetables in their garden if they're growing some, or care about, you know, the roses that they're nurturing in their front yard. Where we go with that is trying to really delve into, like, what are your plants trying to tell you? And often, like, more often than not, they actually do think that their plants are communicating with them. And then pushing that, well, what would the plants want to tell us? What if plants had a voice? So in a way, thinking about plastics that way might be, you know, how do you even start to approach that? We have one activity with plants where it's a postcard. It's a postcard activity to a plant that I've hurt in my life. And it's just a very emotional activity. You know, it's a blank postcard and people can write and people are just emotionally invested. And then they pass it to somebody else and that person gets to respond and talk up, and it opens up a dialogue optionally about that relationship to a plant and what it means when you share that with somebody else. But what if there was an activity around our relationship to plastic, a bag I threw away, you know? And thinking about the whole journey of that plastic piece, rather than thinking about plastic as necessarily the enemy in this, but thinking about it as also somehow having an affective relationship in here. It would be how I would approach it in terms of brainstorming and taking it from there. But I'm happy to talk about that more. And with that, I'll turn it over to STEM.
Yeah, so here comes my rant on
yes.
STEM. You know, I love science, and I'm a science fiction geek, but something fundamentally happened in the late 1950s in American education that got broken and hasn't been fully repaired. So if you look at there was a whole discourse on creativity and imagination in schools in the late 40s and 50s. I'm writing a book right now on that period. Margaret Mead wrote an incredible book published by the United States government called A Creative Life for Your Child that no one reads anymore, but I strongly recommend if you get it. You can buy it cheap on your favorite online book dealer. Right, I bought multiple copies for under $10. Read it. What she was talking about is a humanistic investment in children's creativity, their imagination, that was truly multidisciplinary in the way it was just thought of. Well, with Sputnik, then there was suddenly America was behind in science and the push to make science and technology the central thing driving American education took over. And ever since, every educational reform movement in the United States has been driven by we're behind in science. We're no longer competing with the Soviets to get to space, but we're behind in science. There's not enough science literacy. We're going to lose competition for global markets or whatever the current driver of that is, while social sciences, humanities, arts, everything else in the curriculum has been drained to feed that money into STEM, which has become this unholy monster. Now, we talk about making STEM STEAM, which is to put arts in the middle of STEM, except when you put arts in the middle, it's getting squeezed by both sides, and the only thing that fits is what connects with science. So arts that's in the service of anything other than scientific knowledge or technical skill sets is knocked out when we do that. And so, yeah, my commitment ultimately is to humanities, to the arts and social sciences, and particularly to the imagination and creativity, because those things can change the world in a different way than STEM changes the world. They may empower STEM to be more effective than ever before. But we've got to fight for that. And on our podcast, How Do You Like It So Far, we've done several episodes lately with some educators who are trying to change that in various ways. What it would happen if we centered education around the arts as opposed to science, what would that look like as the topic of one of our episodes. So if this is of interest to you, check out How Do You Like It So Far.
And How Do You Like It So Far is maybe a good place to end it.
Yes, How Do You Like It So Far?
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody.
This is the work we're doing.